Chapter 75. I and ye peace and q and secret la porter loin est difficile aux dames. Et ge scase mesum sur si fate bon number dames qui sont femmes. La Fontaine. Meanwhile, Deronda had been fastened and led off by Mr. Vandernoot, who wished for a brisker walk, a cigar, and a little gossip. Since we cannot tell a man his own secrets, the restraint of being in his company often breeds a desire to pair off in conversation with some more ignorant person, and Mr. Vandernoot presently said, "What a washed-out piece of cambric Grandcourt is. But if he is a favorite of yours, I withdraw the remark." "Not the least in the world," said Deronda. "I thought not. One wonders how he came to have a great passion again, and he must have had to marry in this way. Dolush, his old chum, hints that he married this girl out of obstinacy. By George, it was a very accountable obstinacy. A man might make up his mind to marry her without the stimulus of contradiction. But he must have made himself a pretty large drain of money, eh? I know nothing of his affairs." "What, not of the other establishment he keeps up? Diplo? Of course. He took that of Sir Hugo. But merely for the year. No, not Diplo. Gadsmere. Sir Hugo knows, I'll answer for it." Deronda said nothing. He really began to feel some curiosity, but he foresaw that he should hear what Mr. Vandernoot had to tell without the condescension of asking. Lush would not altogether own to it, of course. He's a confident and go-between of Grandcourt's. But I have it on the best authority. The fact is, there's another lady with four children at Gadsmere. As he has had the upper hand of him these 10 years and more, and by what I can understand, has it still left her husband for him, and used to travel with him everywhere. Her husband's dead now. I found a fellow who was in the same regiment with him, and knew this Mrs. Glasher before she took wing. A fiery dark-eyed woman, a noted beauty at that time, he thought she was dead. They say she has Grandcourt under her thumb still, and it's a wonder he didn't marry her, for there's a very fine boy, and I understand Grandcourt can do absolutely as he pleases with the estates. Lush told me as much as that. What right had he to marry this girl? Said Deronda, with disgust. Mr. Vandernoot, adjusting the end of his cigar, shrugged his shoulders and put out his lips. "She can know nothing of it," said Deronda, emphatically. But that positive statement was immediately followed by an inward query, "Would she have known anything of it?" "It's rather a piquant picture," said Mr. Vandernoot, "Grandcourt between two fiery women. For depend upon it, this light-haired one has plenty of devil in her. I formed that opinion of her at Lubrin. It's a sort of media and crusa business. Fancy the two meeting. Grandcourt is a new kind of Jason. I wonder what sort of a part he'll make of it. It's a dog's part at best. I think I hear Risteri now, saying, Jason. Jason. Apostrophe these fine women generally get hold of a stick. Grandcourt can bite, I fancy," said Deronda. "H he is no stick. No, I meant Jason. I can't quite make out Grandcourt. But he's a keen fellow enough, uncommonly well built too. And if he comes into all this property, the estates will bear dividing. This girl, whose friends had come to beggary, I understand, may think herself lucky to get him. I don't want to be hard on a man, because he gets involved in an affair of that sort. But he might make himself more agreeable. I was telling him a capital story last night, and he got up and walked away in the middle. I felt inclined to kick him. Do you suppose that is inattention or insolence, now?" "Oh, a mixture. He generally observes the forms. But he doesn't listen much," said Deronda. Then, after a moment's pause, he went on, "I should think there must be some exaggeration or inaccuracy in what you have heard about this lady at Gadsmere." "Not a bit, depend upon it. It has all lain snug of late years. People have forgotten all about it. But there the nest is, and the birds are in it. And I know Grandcourt goes there. I have good evidence that he goes there. However, that's nobody's business but his own. The affair has sunk below the surface. I wonder you could have learned so much about it, said Deronda, rather dryly. Oh, there are plenty of people who knew all about it, but such stories get packed away like old letters. They interest me. I like to know the manners of my time contemporary gossip, not antediluvian. These dryasdist fellows get a reputation by raking up some small scandal about Semiramis or Nitocris, and then we have 1,001 poems written upon it by all the warblers big and little. But I don't care a straw about the faux pas of the mummies. You do, though. You are one of the historical men more interested in a lady when she's got a rag face and skeleton toes peeping out. Does that flatter your imagination? Well, if she had any woes in her love, one has the satisfaction of knowing that she's well out of them. Ah, you are thinking of the media, I see. Deronda then chose to point to some giant oaks worth looking at in their bareness. He also felt an interest in this piece of contemporary gossip, but he was satisfied that Mr. Vandernoot had no more to tell about it. Since the early days, when he tried to construct the hidden story of his own birth, his mind had perhaps never been so active in weaving probabilities about any private affair as it had now begun to be about Gwendolyn's marriage. This unavowed relation of Grandcourt's could she have gained some knowledge of it, which caused her to shrink from the match, a shrinking finally overcome by the urgence of poverty. He could recall almost every word as he had said to him, and in certain of these words he seemed to discern that she was conscious of having done some wrong, inflicted some injury. His own acute experience made him alive to the form of injury which might affect the unavowed children and their mother. Was Mrs. Grandcourt, under all her determined show of satisfaction, gnawed by a treble-headed grief, self-reproach, disappointment, jealousy? He dwelt especially on all the slight signs of self-reproach. He was inclined to judge her tenderly, to excuse, to pity. He thought he had found a key now by which to interpret her more clearly. What magnifying of her misery might not a young creature get into who had wedded her fresh hopes to old secrets? He thought he saw clearly enough now why Sir Hugo had never dropped any hint of this affair to him, and immediately the image of this Mrs. Glasher became painfully associated with his own hidden birth. Gwendolyn knowing of that woman and her children, marrying Grandcourt, and showing herself contented, would have been among the most repulsive of beings to him, but Gwendolyn, tasting the bitterness of remorse for having contributed to their injury, was brought very near to his fellow feeling. If it were so, as he had got to a common plane of understanding with him on some difficulties of life which a woman is rarely able to judge of with any justice or generosity. For, according to precedent, Gwendolyn's view of her position might easily have been no other than that her husband's marriage with her was his entrance on the path of virtue, while Mrs. Glasher represented his forsaken sin. And Deronda had naturally some resentment on behalf of the Hagers and Ishmaels. Undeniably, Deronda's growing solicitude about Gwendolyn depended chiefly on her peculiar manner toward him. And I suppose neither man nor woman would be the better for an utter insensibility to such appeals. One sign that his interest in her had changed its footing was that he dismissed any caution against her being a coquette setting snares to involve him in a vulgar flirtation, and determined that he would not again evade any opportunity of talking to her. He had shaken off Mr. Vandernoot, and got into a solitary corner in the twilight, but half an hour was long enough to think of those possibilities in Gwendolyn's position and state of mind, and on forming the determination not to avoid her, he remembered that she was likely to be at tea with the other ladies in the drawing room. The conjecture was true, for Gwendolyn, after resolving not to go down again for the next 4 hours, began to feel, at the end of one, that in shutting herself up she missed all chances of seeing and hearing, and that her visit would only last 2 days more. She adjusted herself, put on her little air of self-possession, and going down, made herself resolutely agreeable. Only ladies were assembled, and Lady Pentreath was amusing them with a description of a drawing room under the Regency, and the figure that was cut by ladies and gentlemen in 1819, the year she was presented when Deronda entered. "Shall I be acceptable?" he said. "Perhaps I had better go back and look for the others. I suppose they are in the billiard room." "No, no, stay where you are," said Lady Pentreath. "They were all getting tired of me. Let us hear what you have to say." "That is rather an embarrassing appeal," said Deronda, drawing up a chair near Lady Malinger's elbow at the tea table. I think I had better take the opportunity of mentioning our songstress," he added, looking at Lady Malinger, "unless you have done so."
"Oh, the little Jewess," said Lady Malinger.
"No, I have not mentioned her. It never entered my head that anyone here wanted singing lessons."
"All ladies know someone else who wants singing lessons," said Deronda.
"I have happened to find an exquisite singer," here he turned to Lady Pentreath. "She is living with some ladies who are friends of mine, the mother and sisters of a man who was my chum at Cambridge. She was on the stage at Vienna, but she wants to leave that life and maintain herself by teaching."
"There are swarms of those people, aren't there?" said the old lady.
"Are her lessons to be very cheap or very expensive?"
"Those are the two baits I know of."
"There is another bait for those who hear her," said Deronda.
"Her singing is something quite exceptional, I think.
She has had such first-rate teaching, or rather first-rate instinct with her teaching, that you might imagine her singing all came by nature."
"Why did she leave the stage, then?" said Lady Pentreath.
"I'm too old to believe in first-rate people giving up first-rate chances."
"Her voice was too weak."
"It is a delicious voice for a room. You who put up with my singing of Schubert would be enchanted with hers," said Deronda, looking at Mrs. Raymond.
"And I imagine she would not object to sing at private parties or concerts.
Her voice is quite equal to that."
"I am to have her in my drawing room when we go up to town," said Lady Malinger.
"Why, you shall hear her then.
I have not heard her myself yet, but I trust Daniel's recommendation.
I mean my girls to have lessons of her."
"Is it a charitable affair?" said Lady Pentreath.
"I can't bear charitable music."
Lady Malinger, who was rather helpless in conversation, and felt herself under an engagement not to tell anything of Mira's story, had an embarrassed smile on her face, and glanced at Deronda.
"It is a charity to those who want to have a good model of feminine singing," said Deronda.
I think everybody who has ears would benefit by a little improvement on the ordinary style.
If you heard Miss Lapidus here," he looked at Gwendolyn Earps, "you would revoke your resolution to give up singing."
"I should rather think my resolution would be confirmed," said Gwendolyn.
"I don't feel able to follow your advice of enjoying my own middlingness."
"For my part," said Deronda, "people who do anything finely always inspire me to try. I don't mean that they make me believe I can do it as well, but they make the thing, whatever it may be, seem worthy to be done.
I can bear to think my own music not good for much, but the world would be more dismal if I thought music itself not good for much.
Excellence encourages one about life generally. It shows the spiritual wealth of the world.
But then, if we can't imitate it, it only makes our own life seem the tamer," said Gwendolyn, in a mood to resent encouragement founded on her own insignificance.
"That depends on the point of view, I think," said Deronda.
"We should have a poor life of it if we were reduced for all our pleasure to our own performances.
A little private imitation of what is good is a sort of private devotion to it, and most of us ought to practice art only in the light of private study preparation, to understand and enjoy what the few can do for us.
I think Miss Lapidus is one of the few.
She must be a very happy person, don't you think?" said Gwendolyn, with a touch of sarcasm, and a turn of her neck toward Mrs. Raymond.
"I don't know," answered the independent lady. "I must hear more of her before I say that.
It may have been a bitter disappointment to her that her voice failed her for the stage, said Juliet Fenn, sympathetically. I suppose she's past her best, though, said the deep voice of Lady Pentreath. On the contrary, she has not reached it, said Deronda. She is barely 20. And very pretty, interposed Lady Malinger, with an amiable wish to help Deronda. And she has very good manners. I'm sorry she's a bigoted Jewess. I should not like it for anything else, but it doesn't matter in singing. Well, since her voice is too weak for her to scream much, I'll tell Lady Clementina to set her on my 9 granddaughters, said Lady Pentreath. And I hope she'll convince 8 of them that they have not voice enough to sing anywhere but a church. My notion is that many of our girls nowadays want lessons not to sing. I have had my lessons in that, said Gwendolyn, looking at Deronda. Why, you see, Lady Pentreath is on my side. While she was speaking, Sir Hugo entered with some of the other gentlemen, including Grandcourt, and standing against the group at the low tea table said, What imposition is Deronda putting on you, lady, slipping in among you by himself? Wanting to pass off an obscurity on us as better than any celebrity, said Lady Pentreath, pretty singing Jewess who is to astonish these young people. You and I, who heard Catalina in her prime, are not so easily astonished. Sir Hugo listened with his good-humored smile as he took a cup of tea from his wife, and then said, Well, you know, a liberal is bound to think that there have been singers since Catalani's time. Ah, you are younger than I am. I dare say you are one of the men who ran after Alchirisi. But she married off, and left you all in the lurch. Yes, yes, it's rather too bad when these great singers marry themselves into silence before they have a crack in their voices. And the husband is a public robber. I remember Larouche saying, a man might as well take down a fine peal of church bells and carry them off to the steps, said Sir Hugo, setting down his cup and turning away, while Deronda, who had moved from his place to make room for others, and felt that he was not in request, sat down a little apart. Presently he became aware that, in the general dispersion of the group, Gwendolyn had extricated herself from the attentions of Mr. Vandernoot, and had walked to the piano, where she stood apparently examining the music which lay on the desk. Will anyone be surprised at Deronda's concluding that she wished him to join her? Perhaps she wanted to make amends for the unpleasant tone of resistance with which. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.